Well, we are at a place where we're ready to talk about John Calvin. Last time, we spent most of the time talking about Thomas Munzer and the peasant revolt. We closed by introducing John Calvin. Now we have moved from Germany back to Switzerland. Before, we were in Zurich with Ulrich Zwingli and the rise of the Anabaptist, and now we move to the city of Geneva that we're going to be talking about. We're not there yet. I want to go back and review some for you, though, what we talked about. We missed last Sunday night because we had our fifth Sunday sing, and so let's just go back and talk a little bit about what we looked at last week. We saw that John Calvin was born on July the 10th, 1509, in France, not far from Paris. He was raised in a staunch Roman Catholic family. His local bishop employed Calvin's father as an administrator in the town's cathedral. His father, in turn, wanted John to become a priest, and at the age of 14, he went to Paris. That is, John, at the age of 14, went to Paris, where he began his preparation for university study by learning Latin. At that time, the new theological teachings of the Reformation were spreading through Europe and were there in France and Paris. And by 1527, Calvin had developed friendships with individuals who were reform-minded. And those contacts really set the stage for his eventual conversion and switch to the reformed faith. John enrolled in university to study philosophy, but a short time later, for reasons that are not really clear, his father transferred him to the University of Orléans to study law. Now, remember, it was his dad who wanted him to become a priest. Now, for some reason, he changed his mind and he sent him to study law. Well, after completing his law training, Calvin entered yet another university in 1529 to study Renaissance humanism, which was a European intellectual movement that stressed classical studies, and Calvin really fell in love with that. But also during that period, Calvin learned Koine Greek, which is the language of the New Testament. At some point during the years between 1529 and 1532, John Calvin was converted, and we don't know exactly when and where, but at some point later in life, he wrote about his conversion. In his commentary on the book of Psalms, he wrote, "God, by a sudden conversion, subdued and brought my mind to a teachable frame, which was more hardened in such matters than might have been expected from one at my early period of life. Having thus received some taste and knowledge of true godliness, I was immediately inflamed with so intense a desire to make progress therein that although I did not altogether leave off other studies, yet I pursued them with less passion." And in another account, he wrote, "Being exceedingly alarmed at the misery into which I had fallen, and much more at that which threatened me in view of eternal death, I duty-bound made it my first business to commit myself to your way, condemning my past life, not without groans and tears. And now, O Lord, what remains to a wretch like me but instead of defense earnestly to beg you not to judge that fearful abandonment of your word according to its deserts, from which in your wondrous goodness you have at last delivered me." And so Calvin was converted sometime between 1529 and 1532. By 1532, at the age of 23, Calvin had completed his formal education. He'd also written his first book. It wasn't a book on scripture. It was a commentary on a piece of classical literature. He went to Paris to eventually had it published. But while he was there, one of his friends, one Nicholas Cop, spelled just like Cop, C-O-P, who was the president of the University of Paris, delivered an address to the students and faculty of the university in which he spoke on the need for reform and renewal in the Roman Catholic Church. And he expounded on salvation by grace through faith. And he concluded with a plea for tolerance for the new evangelical reformers. Well, the address was not well received, and it provoked strong reaction from the faculty, who denounced it as heretical, forcing Cop to flee from Paris. Well, Calvin had helped him write the address, and he too was implicated, because when the authorities searched his room, they found a copy of the address in Calvin's own handwriting. And so Calvin as well had to flee, and for the next 3 years, he lived in various places outside of France under various names, pseudonyms. He studied while he was there on his own. He preached. He began to work on the first edition of the Institutes of the Christian Religion, which he first published in 1536. Even though Calvin wrote detailed commentaries on almost every book in the Bible, Institutes, which is an exhaustive explanation of Reformed theology, was his greatest work, which he revised many times throughout his life, and maybe we'll talk some more about that another time. By 1536, Calvin really had disengaged himself completely from the Roman Catholic Church, and he made plans to permanently leave France and go to Strasbourg, Germany, where he hoped to just settle and pursue a quiet life of a scholar there. But because of the presence of imperial and French forces, in the providence of God, of course, he was forced to make a detour to the south that took him to the city of Geneva. Now, he only meant to stay there for one night, but there was a fellow there by the name of William Farrell, who was a fellow French reformer who lived in Geneva, and he begged Calvin to stay there and to assist him in the work of reforming the church there. And Farrell also asked Calvin to use the organizational skills that he had gained in his study of law to discipline the fallen city. That's in quotes. That's how Farrell described it, the fallen city of Geneva. I guess that could be used of any city, couldn't it? The fallen city. And that really began a long, difficult, but ultimately fruitful relationship with that city. Calvin began as a lecturer and as a preacher, but by 1538 he was asked to leave because of theological differences. The theological differences was that he refused to serve communion to members that were living in living openly sinful lives, and it caused a great deal of turmoil among some of those aristocratic citizens. Well, Calvin did leave. He was gone for 3.5 years. He was invited to lead a church of French refugees in Strasbourg, where he had set out originally, to go originally, and By September of 1538, he had taken up his new position, and he really thought that this would be the last time he would move. He expected to spend his entire ministry there. A few months later, he applied for and was granted citizenship. In August of 1540, he married Idalette de Burr. I don't think I put that in your notes. I'm sorry, Idalette de Burr, a widow who had two children from her first marriage. But the following year, in 1541, Geneva had a problem. And they were forced to reconsider their expulsion of Calvin. Church attendance had dwindled, the political climate had changed, and the cardinal over the Swiss Catholics had written a letter and was trying to persuade the city council of Geneva to return to Catholicism. And so the council, searching for an ecclesiastical authority to respond to him, asked Calvin to return. Well, he'd been in Strasbourg for 3.5 years, and his stay there as pastor to the French refugees was very peaceful and happy. He had a family. He was emotionally torn. He really wanted to stay in Strasbourg, but he felt a responsibility to return to Geneva, which he did, and he remained in Geneva until his death. Now, that's where we left off last time. So let's pick up there begin to talk about his years in Geneva. From Geneva, Calvin came to be recognized as a major figure in the Protestant Reformation. While he was there, his workload was staggering. If I complain about my workload, remind me of this, will you? Calvin pastored the St. Pierre Church, in which he preached daily and twice on Sunday. Every day he preached and twice on Sunday. And what was interesting, you know, Calvin was really committed to expository preaching. How committed was he to expository preaching? Well, when he went back to Geneva after he had been in Strasbourg, Germany for 3.5 years, he started his first Sunday back. He started in the very next text where he had left off 3.5 years before. He just picked right up where he had left off before and continued preaching in the same place. He produced commentaries, as I said, on almost every book of the Bible. He wrote dozens of devotionals and doctrinal pamphlets. He revised the Institutes. He worked on that his entire life, and again, we'll mention that again later. He also carried on vast correspondence, as well as trained and sent out scores of missionaries. And he managed to do all of that while constantly battling various ailments, including migraine headaches. The people of Geneva had notoriously lax morals before Calvin came back. And they often, as I mentioned a while ago, before he left, they often balked at his attempts at improving morality. But Calvin's influence this time was everywhere, it really is a kind of overarching presence. And of course, in the same way that we saw earlier about not serving communion to people who were living in sin, Calvin taught church discipline. He taught the discipline of sinning members whose lives did not conform to spiritual standards. And through his leadership, Geneva became the unofficial capital of the Protestant movement. It became a very powerful moral magnet, attracting Protestant exiles from all over Europe. Remember that the Reformation was going on throughout Europe. It was moving out and was influencing people all over Europe. And, of course, the Catholic Church and the political establishments were persecuting those people, and they were fleeing, and many of them came to Geneva, and there Calvin would provide refuge for them. He educated them, and then very often he would send them back out as missionaries, sometimes back to the places from which they had come. And these missionaries formed, among other things, the French Huguenots. In Calvin's own lifetime, the Huguenots really became the French Reformed Church. And another thing that came as a result of that, that we'll discuss more later, was the really causing the conversion of Scotland under the leadership of John Knox, because John Knox also came and sat under the teaching of Calvin. Knox described Geneva as, quote, the most perfect school of Christ since the day of the apostles. And so there were some wonderful things that took place during those years. Over the years, however, Calvin also encountered waves of bitter opposition to his work in Geneva, both from within and without, political as well as religious. In August of 1553, though, a fugitive from ecclesiastical authorities, a man by the name of Michael Servetus, appeared in Geneva. Servetus was a Spanish physician and a Protestant theologian, but he taught some false doctrine. Namely, he criticized at first, later denied the doctrine of the Trinity. And in July of 1530, he had a major dispute in the city of Basel with Johannes Oecolampadius. He was a German Reformed theologian who influenced both Bullinger and Calvin. Servetus was eventually expelled from Basel, and he went to Strasbourg, where Calvin had been before. And there, while he was in Strasbourg, he published a pamphlet against the Trinity. Well, a fellow there by the name of Martin Bucer, who was another German Protestant reformer, who was based in Strasbourg, publicly refuted the tract and asked Servetus to leave, and so he did. He returned then to Basel, and there he published two books on the Trinity, which caused great sensation among the reformers as well as the Catholics. And it was at that time that the Inquisition of Spain ordered the arrest of Servetus. Calvin and Servetus were first brought into contact in 1546 through a common acquaintance. They exchanged letters for a time, debating doctrine. Eventually, Calvin lost patience and refused further correspondence. By that time, Servetus had written around 30 letters to Calvin. Calvin was particularly outraged when Servetus sent him a copy of his own book, a copy of Institutes, Calvin's most important and lifelong work, that was heavily annotated with arguments pointing to errors in his book. And so when Servetus mentioned that he might come to Geneva, Calvin did write back and told him that if he did come, he couldn't assure him of safe conduct. Not necessarily because Calvin was going to do anything, but because he was wanted by a lot of different groups. In 1553, Servetus published The Restoration of Christianity, in which, again, he rejected the doctrine of the Trinity as well as the concept of predestination. And in that same year, Servetus was arrested, and he was taken in for questioning, and his letters that he had written to Calvin were presented as evidence of his heresy. Well, he managed to escape from prison, And the Catholic authorities at that time sentenced him in absentia to death by burning. Well, on his way to Italy, he stopped in Geneva to visit Calvin, where he was recognized and arrested. Calvin's secretary, Nicholas de La Fontaine, composed a list of accusations that was submitted before the court, and the council condemned Servetus as a heretic, and he was sentenced to be burned at the stake. Now, some scholars claim that Calvin and some of the other ministers in Geneva asked that he be beheaded instead of burning. As a matter of fact, I left out a word when I said that they condemned him to death by burning. Actually, the wording of the statement was they condemned him to death by slow burning. And, of course, that was torturous, took a long time. And so there are some scholars who have said that Calvin and some of the others asked that he be beheaded. That plea apparently was refused, and on October the 27th, 1553, Servetus was burned at the stake. After the death of Servetus, Calvin was acclaimed by the Reformed in Geneva as a defender of Christianity. But ever since, there has been a great deal of debate and criticism and even outrage about Calvin's perceived role in the death of Servetus. So what about that? What should be our opinion about that? Well, that's a difficult thing, I confess. It is. We live in a different time. We live in a different culture. While we would agree that it was a harsh and questionable punishment, which to us in the 21st century seems to be excessive to our sensibilities, we also have to remember that the burning of Servetus was the result of deeply held theological, social, and political views of the time. It is true that Calvin and his fellow pastors in Geneva were involved. However, it really would be difficult to find a church leader in the 16th century who acted with more restraint and compassion in this regard. Remember, we talked about this with some of the other reformers. Remember that Calvin, or that Luther rather, called for attacks on German peasants and wrote angry tracts about the Jews. Zwingli supported the execution by drowning of the Anabaptist leader Felix Mantz. And each country of Europe in the 16th century felt that defending its religious views involved taking strong measures against those who disagreed. And I'm not defending that. Don't misunderstand me. But toleration and acceptance of doctrinal differences were simply not 16th century concepts. And so there are some facts that we really need to understand in order to deal with this. And let me just give you those five things that there. Number one, Servetus was guilty of heresy. Okay, there's not any question about that. He was guilty of heresy. Number two, his sentence was in harmony with the spirit of the age. All right, his sentence was in harmony with the spirit of the age. I'm pausing for those of you who are writing these down. Number three, he had already been sentenced to the same punishment by the Spanish Inquisition. Again, none of these make it right. None of these are justification. They're just facts that have to be considered in dealing with this. Number four, and this is one I think that we really need to understand, is that the sentence was pronounced by the councils of Geneva. All right, and Calvin, who had Calvin had no authority either to condemn or to save him. Influence, maybe, but authority, no. You remember we talked about that. It was the city councils at this time still was a state church, and the city councils are the ones that had the authority. And so Calvin had no authority in the matter. And then number five, Calvin and others visited Servetus in his last hours, treated him with kindness, and did all they could to have the sentence changed. And plus, at length, Calvin had tried to change Servetus's mind about his false teachings. And so Servetus had pursued it with knowledge of the culture of what he might face. And so, as I said, it's difficult, but I hope that will help you in dealing with it. All right. Well, during the later years, Calvin's spiritual authority was practically uncontested. I mean, he enjoyed an international reputation as a reformer, really distinct from Luther, because remember, these were two branches of the Reformation. There was the Lutheran branch, and then there was the Reformed branch. And of course, we saw the Radical Reformation too, which was another part altogether. And then there were some more moderate reformers. And so there were these different groups. But he was a reformer distinct from Luther. Initially, Luther and Calvin had mutual respect for one another. However, as we learned earlier, a doctrinal conflict had developed between Luther and Zurich reformer Ulrich Zwingli on the interpretation of the Lord's Supper. And Calvin's opinion, while not the same as Zwingli's, was close enough that it forced Luther to place him in Zwingli's camp. And of course, Luther had no respect, really, no love for Zwingli. Calvin actively participated in debates that were exchanged between the Lutheran and the Reformed branches of the Reformation movement. At the same time, he was very distressed by the lack of unity among the Reformers. And he took a number of steps toward reconciliation. He reconciled with Bullinger by who had taken Zwingli's place in Zurich by signing a treaty between the churches in Zurich and the Geneva churches. He reached out to England when Archbishop of Canterbury Thomas Cranmer called for an ecumenical synod of all the evangelical churches. And Calvin praised the idea. It just unfortunately never materialized. Cranmer was never able to bring it about. Calvin also sheltered in Geneva, again, those who fled the reign of the Catholic Queen Mary Tudor of England, called Bloody Mary. And under the city's protection, they were able to form their own Reformed church under John Knox and William Whittington. And eventually, they carried Calvin's ideas on doctrine and polity back to England and to Scotland. However, Calvin was most interested in reforming his homeland of France. And that's natural, I think. He really wanted to see France come to Christ. He supported the building of churches by distributing literature and sending missionaries. Between 1555 and 1562, more than 100 missionaries were sent to France, And those efforts were funded by the church in Geneva. And not only France, but also churches were planted in Italy and Hungary, in the Netherlands, in Poland, in Germany, and even as far away as a place as Brazil. Within Geneva, Calvin's main concern was creation of a college. And the word college was used differently. You notice usually I use the word university when I'm talking about advanced education, because at that time, college was an institute for the education of children. And that's what Calvin initially wanted to start. A site for the school was selected, and it opened on the 5th of June, 1559. He succeeded in obtaining Theodore Beza, who was a great French Protestant theologian, as a president of the school. And within 5 years, there were 1,200 students in the elementary section of the school and 500 in the advanced, which I suppose we would call the high school. That school, however, eventually became the University of Geneva. In the autumn of 1558, Calvin became ill with a fever, and since he was afraid that he might die before completing the final revision of the institutes, he forced himself to work. The final edition was greatly expanded to the extent that Calvin referred to it as a new work. And that is, the expansion went from 21 chapters in the previous edition to 80 chapters in the final draft, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,400 pages. Shortly after he recovered, though, he strained his voice while preaching, which brought about a violent fit of coughing. And from that point on, really, his health steadily declined. He preached his final sermon in St. Pierre on February the 6th, 1564. On April the 25th of that year, he made his will, in which he left some small funds to his family and to the college. A few days later, the elders of the church, actually he invited the elders of the church to come and to visit him. For him to really give them a farewell address, in which he recounted his life in Geneva, sometimes recalling the bitter hardships that he had suffered. Calvin died on May the 27th, 1564, at the age of 54. His body lay in state for a short time, but because so many people came to see it, the reformers were afraid that they would be accused of fostering a new saints cult. And on the following day, per Calvin's instructions, he was buried in an unmarked grave. And while in the 19th century, a stone was placed to mark a grave traditionally thought to be Calvin's grave, no one really knows for sure the exact location. And you say, well, why the unmarked grave? Well, in one of his last commentaries, Calvin wrote, commenting on the death and burial of Moses, he wrote, "It is good that famous men should be buried in unmarked graves." And that conviction really guided his own burial, because he rejected, of course, the superstitious veneration of the dead, and he wanted no pilgrimages to be made to his grave. Someone has said, and I believe it's apt here, and I wish everyone, every Christian, could hear this, because there are so many misunderstandings and misrepresentations of Calvin and of Calvinism. Somebody has said he had lived to make Christians, not Calvinists. And I think that is well said. In his book, John Calvin, Pilgrim and Pastor, Dr. W. Robert Godfrey writes, Calvin had perhaps written his own best epitaph in Institutes. And this is what he wrote. We may patiently pass through this life in afflictions, hunger, cold, contempt, reproaches, and other disagreeable circumstances, contented with this singular assurance that our King will never desert us, but will give what we need until, having finished our warfare, we shall be called to triumph. You know, again, and that really is all that we're going to talk about tonight, which is good because it's about that time. But I may spend some time. I wanted to talk tonight about the person of Calvin, not his theology. But we may deal with that a little bit. I don't want to go overboard on it because that's really not the focus of this study. We're talking about the Reformation, and I want to continue the flow there as we've been trying to do. But we may take a little time to talk about his theology, and also perhaps to talk about some of those misunderstandings. You know, one of the things that, you know, struck me as I studied again the life of John Calvin was just his emphasis in missions. You know, there are so many people today, Christians today, who say, oh, well, Calvinists don't believe in missions.
That's right.
Calvinists don't believe in evangelism.
That's right.
And, you know, and some would, when I come to the conclusion of the study, would say, oh, hey, wait, what about the 5 points of Calvinism? Well, I would just answer that in the short way by saying his emphasis wasn't the 5 points. His emphasis was bringing the world to Christ.
Amen.